The Jacob cycle is full of tensions. Two main ones that were introduced early on are going to be wrapped up in this chapter and in the next two. One of the two is the fact that Jacob and Laban have an awkward relationship, and Jacob and Esau is the second one. Earlier in Genesis 27, Jacob stole Esau's blessing, and Esau swore that when Isaac, my father, is dead and the days of mourning him are over, I'm going to kill Jacob. And so Jacob in Genesis 28 went to his uncle's land, the land of Haran and Padan Aram. And in Padan Aram, Jacob was going to find a family. He left the promised land to go find a wife. God had promised him a wife and offspring and all the rest. Jacob had none in Genesis 28. And so when you get to Genesis 29, Jacob ends that chapter with two wives. One that he was not expecting after 7 years of hard work. Wakes up after the wedding night and he's married to Leah. But then he agrees to work 7 more years if he can be given Rachel. So immediately he's given Rachel. And he has 14 years of labor for Laban then with two wives. Now what we've seen in the second tension that develops is the tension between Jacob and Laban. So not only are Jacob and Esau's relationship needing some sort of restoration, but Jacob and Laban have to come to a peace as well. What happens in our passage tonight is the Jacob and Laban tension is resolved. And then next week, the next couple of chapters of Genesis, the tension with Esau is resolved. So the earlier tensions introduced in the narrative are being brought full circle, so to speak. How are they going to be dealt with? Well, the narrator is going to tie those loose ends together. Now, Jacob, we have to remember a few things. Jacob worked in that second set of 7 years for Laban after now acquiring a second wife. But over the course of those 7 years, childbearing was difficult. And at some point during those years, each of his two wives gave him two servants. Or each of them gave a servant, resulting in two additional wives. So in 7 years, Jacob had four wives and 12 children by them. And then he agreed to work 6 extra years for Laban. We saw that in Genesis 30 through the first part of 31. He agreed to work 6 additional years pasturing Laban's flock. And he was going to be blessed with whatever the abnormal births would be. And that means those that were striped or spotted or speckled that would stand out. Not because they wouldn't be good animals, they would just be rarer. So according to the deal he struck with Laban, I will pasture your flock and I will take the more rarer of the births. Well, Laban believes this is a great deal and begins to immediately employ countermeasures by removing all the rare ones already from the flock, so that Jacob is essentially having to start from square one, from a ground zero kind of breeding situation. And then, despite Laban's plot, God abundantly blesses Jacob. And in Genesis 31, Jacob, after having all these flocks, after 6 years, says to his two wives, Rachel and Leah, "We have to go. Your father's cheated me. We need to leave." And so Laban is out shearing sheep, which would have taken many days and many men. And Jacob makes his escape. All right. Now, what we need to know about Laban is he's a crafty man and he will not let Jacob slip away like a whisper in the wind. No, he pursues Jacob. They have a confrontation, a conversation about recent events and about those 20 years. And finally, they come to a covenant pact of peace. 20 years, though. 14 revolving around these two wives, and then 6 more as they pasture Laban's flocks. 20 total years, and now Jacob makes his escape. And in verse 22, we learn in verses 22 to 25 that Laban pursues Jacob and has a dream. In verses 26 to 42, Laban and Jacob have a long conversation, and that's really the meat of the whole passage tonight. And then in verses 43 to 55, the aftermath of that conversation is surprisingly positive. They actually come to an agreement, a peaceful arrangement of their relationship. And so we end on a positive note in the chapter. But this will complete chapter 31 of Genesis. And in verses 22 to 25, let's think about this pursuit. We're told this in verse 22. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he and his kinsmen with him, and he took his kinsman with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. Now, we don't know how Laban found out. We don't know who told Laban Jacob was gone. All we know is Laban decides to make pursuit. And so Jacob has a little bit of a head start. It says that on the third day that Jacob had fled, it was told Laban. So this is some good distance Jacob has already gotten. And so then he's going to pursue him for 7 more days to see if he can catch him. So total, Jacob will have been gone approximately 10 days, a week and a half or so. These are probably more approximate numbers because some of the miles would be really difficult if it was kept tight with actually 72 hours specifically with 3 days or even multiplying that times 7. And so these numbers here are telling us Jacob had a little bit of a head start. But Laban was so insistent that even if he worked for over a week or more, he was going to catch Jacob. And I think the reader should be concerned immediately. The reason the reader needs to be concerned is Jacob has worked 20 years. Why can't Laban just let it go? Let it go, Laban. Let him just leave in peace. You know, he slipped away. Who cares? You got 20 years of work out of him. After you already tricked him after the first 7 years had passed. And after you'd already cheated him during wages and sheep pasturing for the last 6 years, Laban just let him go. But Laban isn't going to let him go. Laban isn't going to let him go. And in verse 23, he took his kinsmen with him, which means Laban isn't just going by himself. He's got like a host of people, his family. And this would be very intimidating because Jacob has a bunch of children with him. He's got some wives with him. And Laban's got this posse, if you will, this posse of kinsmen. And they're tracing Jacob's steps and pursue him into the hill country of Gilead, which is east of the Jordan River on that side of the Promised Land. So Jacob has not re-entered the Promised Land. He's in the hill country east of the Jordan River. And it tells us in verse 24, but God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream and by night and said, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. This dream sequence is important because God has intervened in what I think is implied to be a dangerous situation for Jacob. God intervenes in this case, whereas Laban, if left just to his wits and to whatever his plot would be, would no doubt be a danger to Jacob. Knowing this, God intervenes in a dream that night along the way. And what he's told is somewhat confusing. Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. But what if he had something good to say? What would that look like? Or maybe this means don't say anything at all, whether it be good or bad, just stay quiet. What we do know is that Laban does get a little testy with Jacob. He does make some accusations, but he doesn't harm him. He doesn't harm him, which may have been a result of the intervention of God in this case, because Laban is pursuing Jacob for something, at least for some sort of I'm going to get what's mine or what I think is mine. And so the Lord deems it fitting to intervene by night in this dream. And this nocturnal dream seems to be in Jacob's benefit, even though, and we've got to remember this, Jacob doesn't know that God has intervened in Laban's mind in a dream. Jacob doesn't know this. The reader does. And in verse 25, Laban overtook Jacob. What a scene that must have been. Jacob has his tent in one area of the hill country, Laban in another area of it, and it's like they're sort of encamped against each other. You can just imagine like opposing people. It does appear that Jacob is at least traveling with 17 people. He's got himself, his 4 wives, his 12 children, but probably other relatives as well, because he refers to kinsmen later on in the chapter. It's just unclear beyond 17 that we know about who else is there. But there's enough to where these opposing camps, you know, there's going to have to be a decision. What are we going to do? Some kind of conversation? Is this going to result in a big fight? Is this going to end peacefully? The reader doesn't know, and Jacob doesn't know. All he knows is, oh my goodness, Leah, Rachel, is that your dad? Is that your dad coming with kinsmen and in herds? And is he arriving? I can't believe he's found us. Can you imagine the panic they must have felt? And in verses 26 to 42, the inevitable conversation finally takes place. And it's a doozy, friends. This is some kind of exchange between Jacob and Laban. It gets difficult. It doesn't seem like any fists were thrown. But nonetheless, they both have a lot of years of irritation and frustration that's going to come out a little bit, okay? So the cap on it all has been sort of untwisted, and you can just see Jacob and Laban giving expression to their frustration. And in verse 26, Laban goes first, and he says to Jacob, "What have you done that you have tricked me and driven my daughters like captives of the sword?" Now, we need to make a couple comments about this verse. Number one, yes, he did trick Laban. He waited till Laban was away, and then he just left. He didn't give Laban a note. He didn't tell Laban ahead of time, "When you come back, we're not going to be here." Laban went out to shear sheep. Jacob took the opportunity and left. But that second accusation is very interesting to me. "You've driven away my daughters like captives of the sword." Now, the reader knows that is not true. It's not true because earlier in chapter 31, Jacob explains his concern about leaving, and Rachel and Leah say, well, in verse 16, "Do whatever God has said to you." And they're on board with this plan to leave. They don't believe their father has treated them well. In fact, they said in verse 15, "Aren't we regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he's indeed devoured our money." They don't see themselves as being cared for by Laban well at all. So when Laban says, "You've driven away my daughters like captives," the reader knows that's not true. But Laban doesn't realize his daughters are not devoted to him as Laban in particular. They're devoted to Jacob. In verse 27, this question gets me. You know, look at the language here. "Why did you secretly flee and trick me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre?" Now, do you really think, from what we know about Laban, that he said, "I would have just given you a going away party. I would have been, he wanted to just, you know, put on a big show. He would have had music and dancing. It would have been great." I don't think Laban is being sincere here at all. I think he's just being deceptive and manipulative. He wants Jacob to feel guilty, and he wants Jacob to regret leaving. And what he would really love is for Jacob to come back, at least in the sense that Jacob's presence has meant blessing for Laban's household. Even though up to this point, Laban is very frustrated that Jacob is so abundantly blessed, no matter what Laban seems to try to do to him. And in verse 27, he did flee secretly and trick him. But that second statement, just like the one in 26, it's the second statement that's problematic. Laban would not have wanted to send Jacob away. In fact, Laban probably would have done anything he needed to do to prevent them from fleeing. So it seems as if they chose the window of opportunity that was available. And in verse 28, he says, "And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell?" He seems to be talking here about his family, children, his grandchildren. Why now you have done foolishly. So he declares that what Jacob has done is an act of foolishness. And he says, "In a way, you have prevented me from showing how much I love and care for my daughters." Now, the reason we know that's also problematic is because his daughters certainly don't think that. It's not a mutual feeling. They've been treated, they say, like foreigners and people being sold like slaves. And the father is saying here, using the kind of language that would make Jacob feel guilty for having broken these heartstrings, so to speak. So in verse 29, here's what Laban says, and he just puts this out there, and apparently he just wanted Jacob to know this. He says, "It's in my power to do you harm." So he just wanted to let Jacob know. And then he says, "But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.'" And I think with this statement, we should understand Laban's desire was not merely to have a civil conversation with Jacob. I think Laban is reminding Jacob, "I have the power to do you harm," and God intervened. I think indicating that his arrival there, Laban may not have thought it all through of what the end result would be, but Laban wasn't beyond exercising whatever authority he thought he had to do Jacob harm. This is part of the manipulative trickery of Jacob here. And in verse 30, the trickery of Laban. In verse 30, he then says, "And now you have gone away because you have longed greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods?" And yes, Jacob longed to go home. Yes, he longed to go to the homeland. Yes, he longed to go to the promised land. But why did you steal my gods is a question that the reader must qualify very carefully. We know Rachel has stolen the gods, And we know Jacob doesn't know that. We were told this earlier in verse 19. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. Now, the text just doesn't tell us a lot about why. We know it's interesting that Rachel, early on in her relationship with her father, Jacob loved her and was going to marry her after working 7 years. And Laban cheated Rachel from the very beginning out of that relationship. After Jacob woke up after the wedding night, he was married to Leah. So here, Rachel is doing something against her father. The household gods would have been very, very important to Laban. He was a polytheist, and these household gods were portable. They were small enough to be able to conceal. And Rachel has hidden them, and Jacob doesn't know this. So here's what Jacob said, or here's what Laban says. Why did you steal my gods? He thinks Jacob did it. Now, Jacob thinks this is just a baseless accusation. So here in verse 31, Jacob begins to respond. You've got multiple charges laid out, right? You didn't give me time to do this, and you took my family away, and I didn't get to do this, and I wouldn't let you guys go this way. And by the way, you stole my gods, and you tricked me, and you deceived me. So Laban is just letting him have it. And by the way, I had power to harm you, you know? And then in verse 31, Jacob says, because I was afraid, for I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. Now, from what we've learned about Laban, that's not an unreasonable fear. That's a very reasonable thing. If I try to take the family out from under Laban, what's he likely to do? He's likely to respond in kind to try and keep them to whatever proportion that is. And in verse 32, here's what Jacob says about the whole God's accusation. And the reader here gets a gulp in the throat because Jacob says, anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. Oh my. Oh my. Now we know Jacob is basically saying, here's how certain I am that we didn't take your gods. If you found them, you could kill the person that's got them. All right, well, Jacob doesn't know Rachel has them. He has just unknowingly put his wife's, his loved wife, right? Rachel was the one he loved. He has just put her in jeopardy. And in verse 32, he says, in the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that's yours and take it. He wants Laban to literally search their stuff. Well, no greater risk could be paid to Rachel than the fact that her stuff would be gone through. So it tells us, the narrator says, Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Jacob would have never put Rachel's life at risk like this. It's because in his mind, he's so certain there's nothing to worry about. So yes, Laban, I tricked you. I fled. Yes, and it was because I was afraid of what you would do, Laban. But I didn't take your gods. I didn't take anything that's yours. Search our stuff. And if you and your people can find anything that's yours, especially the gods, kill the person. So in verse 33, Laban went into Jacob's tent. And then, after apparently not finding anything, into Leah's tent. And then apparently not after finding anything, goes to the tent of his two female servants, which is, I think is Zilpah and Bilhah. And then he did not find them there. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's. Now, we stop there in our reading of the text. So here's what happens next. He's in Rachel's tent. And in verse 34, Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle. And she sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but he didn't find them. And she said to her father, let my lord, this is just a respectful way of saying to her father, you know, father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you. For the way of women is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household gods. And another way to say this is she is saying, I am unclean. Because it is that time of the month, Dad, and therefore I'm sitting like the law says I should later on in Leviticus. And so later Israelites would be reading this and understanding, all right, this is what was supposed to happen during the menstrual cycle. And so she says, Dad, that's not why I'm getting up. But the household gods are under her. Now, there's a couple of funny things about this. Well, first of all, the reader's thinking, all right, well, we understand why the dad wasn't just saying, all right, well, I haven't clearly searched everywhere. You need to get up. Because this was a picture of uncleanness that she is purportedly engaged in, right? And so the second irony, though, is that these are idols that are under her. Okay? And the idols in this position of uncleanness would be rendered unclean. And an Israelite reading this is sort of a smirk that might cross your face thinking, well, that serves the idols right. I mean, if these household gods are unclean, then in a position of uncleanness, that's exactly the appropriate thing for them to be designated as. Unclean. They're not real. They're an affront to Yahweh. They're an offense. Laban's gods aren't even real. And so in verse 34, it tells us that Laban felt all around the tent, didn't find them. She said, the way of women is upon me in verse 35. And you know what? He leaves the tent. That's it. I mean, he has deemed it, that he has searched everywhere. He did not find them. And in verse 36, Jacob became angry and berated Laban. And he said, what is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued? And in other words, Jacob at this point, having already vented a little bit, has just had enough. Laban has given a thorough search to the tents. He has searched where all of the daughters are and the wives, and yet nothing has been found of Laban's, no household gods in particular. And Jacob continues in verse 37. He says, for you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen that they may decide between us too. And this is a way of inviting Laban to make a legal claim in front of everybody that here's something that's been stolen. So let's enter it on the record that Jacob is a thief or his wives are a thief. But again, Jacob has said, while you can bring them before all the kinsmen, no goods have been found. In verse 38, these 20 years I have been with you. All right? Jacob has probably wanted to say the following things for a long time. So in verse 38, he says, 20 years I've been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried. Which, that's incredible. Jacob's care has been so thorough. God's blessing has been so profound that they have not miscarried. And I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. So any particular food that would have been able to be taken from Laban's flocks, Jacob has not taken food from Laban's flock. It would have been from his own and not Laban's. And then in verse 39, what was torn by wild beasts, I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. It was very standard practice that a shepherd take the remains of a massacred animal to the person he was pasturing for. Because the person whose flock you're pasturing knows how many goats and sheep. And all of a sudden, things start turning up missing. A reasonable assumption on the part of the owner of the flock would be that you're helping yourself to the animals. You're stealing them. Using them, you know, putting them away or giving them away for other use. And so one danger would be if animals came and preyed upon the flock. Well, what the shepherds had to do was take the remains and say, see, I haven't stolen it. A predator got this. And Jacob is saying, anything torn by wild beasts, I didn't bring it to you. I bore the loss myself. And I take that to mean Jacob replaced what was lost in Laban's flock was something of his own. Jacob is emphasizing to Laban, the blessing of God has been so profound, and I have so gone out of my way to treat your flock well. In verse 40, he says, here were the conditions. There I was. By day, the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and sleep fled my eyes. I mean, it must have been a grueling experience, and for 6 years in recent years, he has been pasturing for Laban. Now, verses 41 and 42, the speech finishes with Jacob saying these words. These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock. And you've changed my wages 10 times. Indicating that Laban is constantly trying to re-engineer the profits of the herds and the produce and whatever else Jacob is involved in. And constantly changing it for his own advantage and against Jacob's advantage. And yet, in every case where Laban employs countermeasures, God blesses Jacob's circumstances. Even when Laban is re-engineering them, it ends up working out in Jacob's favor. And so every time, but the point still stands. Laban has been unfair. Laban has been unjust, and that is intolerable, unacceptable. In verse 42, here are Jacob's words to him. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac, had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. So it seems as if the night before this encounter is when Laban had the dream. And Jacob is saying, we had all the blessing of the flock. But had it been totally up to you, Laban, I would have left without nothing. I wouldn't have had anything. And I think that's not an unreasonable accusation, because Laban was not interested in Jacob flourishing. Laban was only interested in Laban flourishing, even if that meant taking from Jacob and cheating Jacob. And so here's what Jacob evaluates the whole previous years to be. He says, God was on my side. That's why things are the way they are. That's why I've been blessed. That's why I've escaped. Because the God of my father, who? The God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had been on my side. And if not, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. But what did God see? God saw that in Laban's household, Jacob was afflicted and treated unfairly. He says, God saw my affliction, the labor of my hands, and that's why he rebuked you last night. There are two titles of God here. The God of Abraham, okay, well, it's not exactly a title of God, but a God in association with another person, a patriarch. But then the second patriarch that's mentioned, Isaac, God is called the fear of Isaac. That's an unusual title. You would expect God of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. You would expect maybe other titles that you've seen up to this point. But the fear of Isaac is only a title given in this chapter in the book of Genesis. It doesn't occur elsewhere. It's unique here. But it seems to be a substitute for God. In other words, he could have said, the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac. But he says, God of Abraham and fear of Isaac. And the word fear here is substituted for the name God. And in my translation, it's capitalized. And maybe in yours as well. And I think that's appropriate because it's indicating the word fear is being used as a name here. Isaac worshiped the one who ought to be feared. And the one who has brought dread and fear to Laban in a dream the night before. And so Jacob is calling God the fear of Isaac, the God who rebuked you last night, Laban. And so, yes, they ought to fear the Lord. And yes, Laban ought to fear. He ought to be afraid that he's been cheating Jacob and was rebuked in a dream. So calling the God of Abraham the fear of Isaac likely has to do with the particular disposition of Laban and the tenor of the whole story with the unfairness and the injustice that we've seen committed by Laban. Who is the God on Jacob's side? Not just the God of Abraham, but the one who is the fear of Isaac. And that should make Laban tremble. This God is on Jacob's side. It also tells us God has seen my affliction. This is something that's mentioned only two other times in the Torah, in the first five books of the Old Testament. It's mentioned in Exodus 3 and in Deuteronomy 26, when God saw the affliction of the Egyptians Israelites in captivity in Egypt, and he brought deliverance. In other words, God sees affliction and brings deliverance. He did it in the case of Jacob, and he's going to do it corporately in the case of the Israelites when they are afflicted by the Egyptians, unfairly and unjustly. So in other words, God sees the injustice of his people. He sees the injustice committed against Jacob. He sees the injustice committed against the Israelites and friends. God sees the affliction of his people in 2016. God sees the injustices committed against the Church of Jesus Christ, and God will act. He will either intervene this side of heaven, or he will raise the wicked for eternal judgment at the end. But they will not escape him, because he's not just properly known as the God of Abraham. He is the fear of Isaac. And they ought to fear him. They ought to tremble before him, because this is the God who is on the side of his people. And that is something that Laban must reckon with, and anyone else that opposes the people of God. So in verses 43 to 55, the result of the conversation they've just had is a covenant. And this might surprise us. I don't think it's a natural expectation in the text that Laban say what he's about to say. I don't know what would be more expected, that Laban maybe lay some other kind of snare for Jacob, or that he just turn around and leave, or that he'd try to harm him anyway. But instead, verse 43 and 44, Laban says these words, "The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for these my daughters or for their children whom they have born? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So Laban initiates a covenant, but it is introduced by a pretty set of false statements that he has said thus far, a pretty outlandish set, I should say. "The daughters are mine, the children are mine, the flocks are mine, all you see is mine." It seems that after all Jacob has said, Laban hasn't learned very much. It's very sad and somewhat pathetic that after all Laban was blessed in associating with Jacob all those years, and after cheating Jacob and manipulating Jacob and deceiving Jacob, that Laban would still say, "All that you see is mine," when we know that's not true. Those wives are Jacob's wives, those children are Jacob's children, and Laban does not have the kind of claim to them that Jacob has. Laban here is deluded. He's deluded and he's deceiving, and this has been his character throughout the chapters his name has appeared. But nonetheless, he does say, "What else can I do for these my daughters or their children?" I think he's indicating we've come as far as we're able to go together. "So come now, let's make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." The emphasis here, you and me, you and I. The separation of Jacob and Laban is what is being set up here. And we're going to see duplications of events. Things are going to start coming up in twos. They're going to establish two things to symbolize the agreement. They're going to eat two meals. They're going to name the place two words. It's going to establish a separation. This is what Jacob is doing. And this is what Laban is calling it. And so the dual nature of what we're about to read emphasizes the separation between these two. They're not united. They are going their separate ways. So in verses 45 to the end, here's what Jacob does. He takes a stone in verse 45 and sets it up as a pillar. And then in verse 46 says to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." And they took stones and made a heap. So what are the two symbols here? First a pillar and then a pile of rocks. Both of these things are to symbolize in some way an agreement under the Lord. Pillars would often do this, but this gathering of stones, this heap, was to be a visible reminder of this truce, of this parting of ways that they're coming to. Then it tells us they took the stones, made a heap, and they ate there. It was very customary in the ancient Near East when you make a pact or some sort of covenantal agreement to follow it up with a meal. And that kind of fellowship was a way of sealing the deal, so to speak, breaking bread together. And in this case, gathering the stones, having raised the pillar, they do this and eat there by the heap. And then you get a couple names. In verse 47, Jacob calls the place Jagar Sahadutha, but Jacob calls it Galeed. Well, I like Galeed a lot easier. It's easier to say. It's easier to spell. It doesn't even take as long to write. So I'm for that title. And Galeed here, though, is the Hebrew word for Laban's name for it, Jagar Sahadutha. It's the same place. But both mean something like a witness heap. A witness heap. So this heap of stones and this raised pillar, it is symbolizing the witness of these two things to the agreement they've made. And just like Deuteronomy says that these legal conclusions can be ratified by two to three witnesses, it seems that this pillar and this pile of stones could function symbolically as a kind of dual witness to this pact made between Jacob and Laban. But not just between Jacob and Laban. Everybody else that's there. You got to think about it this way, friends. The separation of Jacob and Laban is going to mean the separation of Leah and Rachel from Laban. From Leah and Rachel's children from Laban. This is a total parting of ways between families. Jacob is heading to the promised land. Laban isn't going there. He's going back without his household gods, but he's going to find something to worship, I'm sure. Nonetheless, he is going back to continue in his non-promised land existence. And in verse 49, Jacob, having named it Galeed, named it Galeed in verse 48 and Mizpah in verse 49, "For he said, 'The Lord watch between you and me.'" So naming it in association with witness is one thing. Mizpah basically means watchtower or watching. so that the Lord is going to be the one they're entering this covenant before. God is able to distinguish who keeps covenants and who doesn't, who keeps the pact and who won't. So here's what Laban says. The Lord watch between you and me. I think I must have skipped part of verse 48. I just realized what I said earlier at the very end of verse 48 about Jacob naming it Galeed. It says that Laban did, and this would basically be in agreement with what Jacob has said. In verse 49, and Mizpah, for he said, the Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. Now, that's an interesting turn of phrase if they're leaving friends. I don't think we should say they're leaving friends. They don't even trust each other very much. It tells us here in Laban's words, the Lord will watch when we're out of one another's sight, as if Laban doesn't trust Jacob and Jacob doesn't trust Laban. They're basically going to say, the Lord's going to make sure we keep this pact. He's going to know and trust, or know the heart, and we should trust that. In verse 50, Laban goes on to say, if you oppress my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. So Laban wants his daughters to be treated rightly by Jacob. The irony is, in his daughters' own words, they think they were mistreated by their father Laban. So Laban's sort of blind to this, right? But nonetheless, he says, essentially, take my daughters and don't oppress them. Don't take any other wives besides them. He's already got four. I don't know how many more would be too many. At least it seems, according to Laban, you shouldn't take any more than what you have. And in verse 51, Laban then says, see this heap and the pillar which I've set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. So Jacob and Laban don't trust each other, and they've agreed that this is going to be a kind of boundary between our families. You stay on your side, I'll stay on my side, we'll go back to our respective lands. Then Laban says, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. It seems that he's invoking Jacob's God here, the true God. Because we know Laban worships household gods and other things, and so Laban is not a Yahweh worshiper in the sense that counts. So he's probably conforming to Jacob's way of thinking about the scenario. But he's basically putting it all before the Lord. Let your God judge between us. And so Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. In this chapter, it's the only time this title, Fear of Isaac, is used, and for the same reasons we've discussed. Then it tells us in verses 54 and 55, the last two verses of the chapter, that Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread, and they ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. A sacrifice is often appropriate for the binding of some sort of pact, as well as and when sacrifices were made. If an animal was sacrificed, the idea was that if I break this pact, may I become like this animal, just, you know, cut in half or killed. That's how serious we want to enter into this agreement with this attitude of, I'm going to carry it through. Then they ate bread, spent the night there. So while the night before, Laban may have intended to do Jacob harm, here they have this conversation and they all spend the night there together. If I were Jacob, I'd be sleeping with one eye open. I'm just saying. I don't know that I would fully trust that Laban sleeping in my midst would be totally safe. But nonetheless, they all sleep there for the final night together. This is the last night of Laban with his daughters. This is the last night of Laban with his grandchildren. So this is a big deal. And Laban knows that after this night's over, that's it. And in verse 55, early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters, and he blessed them. And then Laban departed and returned home. There is a sweet irony here, and that earlier in the passage, Laban said, oh, you prevented me from giving my daughters, you know, a kiss goodbye. Well, here he actually does and blesses them, but then departs and returns home. This is the last time we see Laban in this story of Jacob. It's the last time Laban appears in the book of Genesis. It's the last time Laban appears in the Bible. So this is the last occasion and encounter with this person. Some readers might be relieved by that, because wherever this guy has been invoked, he's been nothing but trouble for Jacob. So in one sense, there's relief. But this is a coming full circle where a tension between Laban and Jacob had been earlier introduced, but is now resolved by this peaceful covenant that they have made with one another. And I think when we look at a story like this, friends, and we see God working in the mysterious ways he did in Jacob's life and blessing him, with speckled and spotted and striped animals and the weird ways that happened, all along, the blessing of God is being tied to God's own power, not Jacob's cleverness and not Laban's opposition. Even though Jacob makes foolish decisions, even though Laban has made foolish decisions, God is the one who comes out in these stories looking great and exalted. Jacob needs the Lord and indeed worships him. Laban needs to know Yahweh, but leaves and goes back to his polytheistic way of life. We need to know that what happens on an individual level with Jacob is going to be true on a larger scale for the Israelites. When they are afflicted, God will see their affliction and he will deliver them. Moses will be raised up and he will be sent to Pharaoh to say, "Let my people go." But there was no greater affliction seen by anyone in the history of redemption than when God looked upon the sinful captivity of sinners in this world and sent us his Son. That was the greatest response to affliction that you could have imagined. Greater than delivering Jacob, greater than delivering Moses, was the exodus that Jesus brought with the cross and resurrection. The greatest and new exodus that surpassed any beforehand. God, think of it, friends, God saw us in our affliction. He saw us in our deepest need, in our greatest time of trial, of sinful, soulful, deserving of judgment. He saw us in our affliction. From the foundation of the world, names were written in the Lamb's Book of Life so that in our affliction we would know the answer and remedy brought about by God's own initiative. God sent forth his Son. We didn't deserve it. We didn't merit it. And so we can rejoice like Jacob, that in our affliction we can say, God is on my side. And that is a statement of boldness that we should find the confidence from Scripture to be able to say. We need to be able to know with Jacob's confidence here, like he says in verse 42, that if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, had not been on my side, I would have been sent away empty-handed. The Bible tells us this in Romans chapter 8. If God is for us, then who can be against us? And yes, he goes on to list in Romans 8 all kinds of things that can be temporally against you, whether that be nakedness and sword and famine and opposition and hostility. But if God is for us, can any of those things ultimately prevail? Paul says in Romans 8 that we are more than conquerors in him who loved us. And so we can look at Jacob's story here and the great trust that he demonstrated. And we can draw a line from there to Romans 8 and we can say, well, how much more if God is for us? Can we trust him in our difficulty, in our affliction? Because nothing can separate us from his love. Nothing can break the new covenant he has secured for us in Christ. Because God saw me in my affliction and he sent his Son to take my iniquity and yours. That means we can say that in Christ, God is for me. Not because I deserve it. God is for me because in Christ I am united with his Son, and God will not turn away from his Son, and he will not turn away from his people. On the cross, the Father forsook the Son so that we could be forever not forsaken by the Father, but instead relished and embraced and enjoyed by God and in God for all eternity. Israel was a treasured possession from among the nations. How much more is the church of Jesus Christ loved and beloved by God? In Christ, brothers and sisters, we are not a tolerated people. God does not just put up with us, you know. And sometimes we can talk that way, and ultimately it's nonsensical in light of the gospel because there are deeper truths that inform us to better language. We are treasured in the gospel. We are a people bought, and we are a people redeemed, and God is on our side. And if God is for us, who can be against us? He takes all things and works them for our good and for his glory.